This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, August 11th, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar.
Ozarks at Large is brought to you in part by Pack Rat Outdoor Center in Fayetteville, dedicated to environmental responsibility and serving the area for 35 years. Pack Rat offers a selection of footwear, canoes and kayaks, camping gear, plus urban and outdoor clothing. A fan page is available on Facebook or packrat.biz for events calendar or more information.
But first, public school starts next week around Arkansas, and Congress, as directed by the Obama administration, was to have by this time prepared a bill to reform public education standards. Congress failed to act, so the Obama administration has decided to proceed with reform using its own curriculum. So how will this play out in Arkansas? Jacqueline Froelich reports.
If it were given a grade, Congress would flunk in its assignment to reform the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, commonly referred to as No Child Left Behind, NCLB for short. Signed into law in 2002 by George W. Bush, NCLB aims to improve student achievement, especially among economically disadvantaged and racially diverse populations. NCLB requires strict accountability, improved educational methods proven by scientific research, and expanded parental involvement and local controls by districts. The end result is supposed to be steady academic progress in reading, math, and science, improved teacher quality, more resources to schools, and support for early language and reading skills. Paul Hewitt is an assistant professor of educational leadership at the University of Arkansas.
The big philosophical thing was accountability. As we looked at, you know, over 10 years ago, and actually for the last 25 years, when you disaggregated, when you broke out subpopulations of students, you recognized that just getting the average for all students wasn't giving you an effective picture of education. We knew that Hispanic students, we knew that Black students were underperforming. And the objective of No Child Left Behind was to bring those students up to perform at the same level as the white students within our population, thus No Child Left Behind. And the whole idea of closing that achievement gap, that gap that exists between different ethnic groups within our society.
And accountability means lots and lots of tests. Each state must measure every public school student's progress in reading, math, and science in each of grades 3 through 8, and at least once during grades 10 through 12. And collectively, if students in a particular school don't reach annual benchmarks set higher and higher each passing year under NCLB, that school will fail. As a result of that pressure, many teachers say they are teaching to the test, teaching their students test content rather than creative curriculum. And by 2014, 100% of American students must meet proficient standards. That's just 2 years away. When the law was first passed, Professor Hewitt was serving as school superintendent in California.
It's kind of a little bit unrealistic to think 100% of the kids will be above average, unless you're in Lake Wobegon. Where, you know, all the women are strong and all the men are good looking and all the women are above average, we recognized that there would become a reality, and that reality has started to set in.
The Obama administration 16 months ago introduced its blueprint for reform, hoping Congress would act to reauthorize NCLB. But with nothing on the table, the White House and Secretary of Education Arne Duncan announced August 8th a forthcoming strategy to relax NCLB by providing more flexibility to districts and schools. The Secretary of Education has the legal authority to waive statutory or regulatory requirements of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. Although details have yet to be released, waivers will be granted to applicant states if they agree to prep high school graduates for college and careers, improve teacher performance, and account for student achievement, but in a more flexible way.
I think all of them are going to apply. I mean, I would be surprised if all states didn't apply for some waivers or relief in this situation, because it looks bad when you have your best schools. I mean, we've seen national blue ribbon schools who are classified as underperforming. Something's wrong with that picture.
Arkansas will apply. Seth Blomley is spokesperson for the Arkansas Department of Education.
Back in, I guess it was March, the State School Board sent Arne Duncan, the U.S. Department of Education Secretary, a letter requesting requesting an exemption from the annual yearly progress numbers, and the rationale behind it is that, well, you know, we're implementing a new new curriculum standards called Common Core, which will start this fall for grades K through 2, and over the next couple of years after that will be fully implemented through grade 12. And so we feel like that teachers and administrators are going to have enough on their plate instituting those standards without having to worry about their students meeting increasing percentage goals for these targets, because by 2013-14, you have to have 100% of your kids to be proficient. So we think that's going to be really tough to meet for the schools, and so we think they need some help, and a lot of other states feel the same way about this. And I think Secretary Duncan is sympathetic to what the states are the pinch we're feeling on this. And so while he's tentatively denied what we requested back in March, he's now setting up a system where we're going to be able to apply for waivers in exchange for meeting certain education reforms required by Washington, and we feel good about those. We feel good that we'll be able to meet the requirements of the Obama administration on this, but you know, we can't say 100% for sure that we're going to do this until, and you know, we still need to see exactly what they're going to be offering, but we feel, you know, overall, I mean, we can say pretty sure that, you know, we feel good about meeting those requirements.
Blomley did say state schools have made lots of progress under NCLB.
You know, the benchmark scores pretty much bear that out, and we've just had consistent improvement on the benchmarks since at least 2005. They've gone up each year and just about every category, the math, the literacy, science, from grades 3 throughout, and so we feel really good about that. I mean, as far as schools that are in school improvement because of not meeting annual yearly progress, we have 425 schools out of 1,081 in Arkansas that are on school improvement. So, I mean, obviously, I mean, that's a number, you know, we would like to see reduced. We want to do better, and so that's something that Dr. Kimbrell is consistently working on.
Every year, detailed report cards are issued on district and school performance, noting success and failure. Also included in the report cards are student achievement data, broken out by race, ethnicity, gender, English language proficiency, migrant status, disability status, and low-income status, as well as important information about the professional qualifications of teachers. But once a school is listed as failing, certain students have the option to transfer to an achieving school within their district. And if problems continue, the Arkansas Department of Education steps in, providing supplemental education services, perhaps terminating teachers, staff, and top administrators, basically restructuring the school. No schools have been restructured yet in Arkansas, but as you heard, 425 out of 1,081 schools are in need of improvement. Details on waivers for states seeking exemption from No Child Left Behind will be released by the Obama administration mid-September. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. And from his mobile office, I think maybe in Franklin County, is Michael Tilley. He is the editor and publisher of thecitywire.com that covers home, that covers business, politics, culture, and more in the Fort Smith region. How are you, sir?
I am doing well. I spent the first part of this week covering a major story we thought we had in Fort Smith. I walked outside one morning and my yard was wet, and I looked across the road, my neighbor's yard was wet. To the left and the right of me, their yards are wet, and I thought, what are the chances that all of us could have a water leak at the same time? apparently, Kyle, there's this thing called rain, and it's an amazing cycle. You know, you have evaporation and condensation and warm and cold air masses, and this stuff falls from the sky. So that was just new concept to us. We thought we had a breaking story, but we were told that it's happened before.
Perhaps not in recent memory, but I think we do have scientific proof that it has happened before. There were some relatively new numbers about metro personal incomes in Arkansas in the eight largest metro areas. All of them had gone up in the when compared to the previous year's numbers.
You know, from 2008 to 2009, the metro incomes in Arkansas all dived. I think there might have been one or two exceptions, but they all declined. So in 2010, they were up. That's obviously good news. They're up. Some economists we talked to said, well, they're up because you had easy comparisons to 2009. And they also pointed out that the inflation rate jumped from 0.2% to 1.8%. So I think it's still good news. Incomes are up. That's the right direction. Yes, we were comparing against low 2009 numbers, and yes, the higher inflation rate will cut into that income in terms of it being disposable. But it's a good report, and let's hope that the 2011 figures, which we'll get about this time in 2012, will be just as we'll continue that trend.
Personal incomes up in the larger areas of Arkansas. The city of Fort Smith is going to look at the efficiency of water and sewer operations in the city. What's going to happen with that?
Well, I think the city, there are several reasons they're doing that. Number one, we have some sales taxes that support some significant bond work, both to enhance our water system, Lake Fort Smith expansion, the addition of larger pipes to move more water to the Fort Smith area, and also wet weather sanitation work. Mm. And this is multi-million dollar. This isn't just a million here or there. It's $30 million at a time, $70 million at a time. So I think what the city directors are wanting to know is, let's just look at this. Are we as efficient as we can be with this department and how we spend this money? Do we have the right people in place, the right policies in place? It's just, you know, it probably should have happened. This kind of review maybe should have happened years ago, but it'll be interesting. The consultants are going to look at it. They're going to look at rate structures. They're going to look at how the department works. So hopefully it's healthy. It would appear to be healthy. I mean, to have someone from the outside come and look at what you're doing and hopefully give you some good, honest, constructive criticism, tell you what you're doing right also. Now, there have been a few critics, and this is what kind of puzzles me. You know, some of the same people who have badgered the city about they need to be more efficient and they need to, you know, use their dollars better. Well, now the city is doing that, and some of these same people are saying, well, look, they're bringing in a consultant to tell them they need to raise rates because they don't have the nerve to do it themselves. So city staff, it seems like sometimes they can't win for losing, you know, damned if you do and damned if you don't. But hopefully it'll be a good exercise for the city.
And finally, yesterday, more than 700 people gathered in Fort Smith to say goodbye to a real champion of the city and someone who has been a very important part of it for decades, and that was Samuel Sicard.
Right. It was an amazing service. Like you said, 700 people there. Prior to the service, there was the funeral procession that traveled down Garrison Avenue past First National Bank. Obviously, Sam Sicard, the president, chairman, and CEO of that large bank corporation, which owns Bank of Rogers there in Northwest Arkansas. I mean, it's a very large regional banking operation. Mr. Sicard, who's just he's involved in everything, he supported everything, but he's you know, he never would take credit. I mean, he would go out of his way to refuse to take credit. I mean, it's just the darnest thing I've ever seen. But he was very humble, but very influential. I mean, I wrote in a recent essay that not since Raleigh Borum died, the Baldor chief, not since he died in 2006, have I been as concerned about how you fill a leadership gap in a community. And I'm concerned. I mean, Mr. Sicard, he impacted the community in ways we'll never, ever know, just because he was so humble and he didn't want credit for it. But it was a great service. His son, Sam T. Sicard, delivered just an outstanding eulogy. And it's just, I'm amazed at people who can eulogize a parent and, you know, keep their wits. He never once broke down. Great speech. Just he really manned up, so to speak, and just really honored his father with some great comments. But it'll be interesting to see how that bank goes forward. But it's a big, big loss to the region, to the Fort Smith region, and I would say to the state banking industry.
Michael Tilley is the editor and the publisher of thecitywire.com. It covers politics, business, culture, and more for the Fort Smith region. Thanks for pulling over and talking with me, and safe travels the rest of your trip.
You're welcome, and I'm glad you made it back from Colorado well.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. Have a good week.
All right.
This is Ozarks at Large. Today's stop along Route 66 is in Galena, Kansas. On the north side of Main Street, you'll find a restored service station, and inside you'll find Melba the Mouth. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has the story.
The reason they call me Mouth, I do have a tendency to talk a little bit too fast, so sometimes you have to slow me down because I'm originally from Panama City, Florida, and this is how we task it. If you don't talk this fast down there, you get run over. Plus, I'm a blonde, so there you go.
Melba is one of the members of four women on the route. The group is working to restore buildings along Route 66 in Galena, Kansas. They currently own and operate a restored Canotex service station. The white square building with red trim is home to a Route 66 memorabilia shop and restaurant. Melba says they see about 4,000 visitors, and about three-fourths of them are Europeans. While most of the international travelers speak some English, she is conscious of slowing down her speech while she flips through a scrapbook to tell guests the four women on the route story.
I always know when I start talking fast because people's eyes get really big and they don't want to ask you to slow down because they think it's rude. And I'll say, oh, am I talking fast? And they're like, you know, shaking their head. Yeah, okay. Okay, let me show you. This is what we call the nickel tour. Usually we ask people where they're from. That way we can determine if we have to slow down, talk to them, or if they, we always, when they say, you know, they're from some place like Spain or something. Spain, Italians, and French are usually the ones that don't speak very much English. Everybody else, they try to speak English. So we always, so you have a little bit of English or a lot of English, and they tell you. But this is a tour. Now, like I said, my name is Melba Rigg. I'm one of the original owners of Four Women on the Route. Me and my sister started this company in 2006.
The sisters intended to use the building as a farmer's market and memorabilia shop, but that changed when they discovered that an old mining boom truck on their lot had a special connection to the Disney Pixar movie Cars.
When we got this building, this truck right here was parked against that far wall with a tree growing up through the boom. It had been there an average of 25 to 30 years. So when we got it, Galena asked us to get rid of it because it was an eyesore. So we did. We sold it to a local farmer, not knowing it was tomato. Michael Wallace, who's the voice of the Sheriff Car and the editor of Route 66, The Mother Road, and countless other books like Jesse James and Civil War, he's actually lives in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He's an expert on Route 66. They picked him up in the year 2000 in St. Louis, drove him to California, and back again to do the research on the movie. He got a hold of us and said, get it back, it's tomato. I'm like, tohu? We bought the building in June of 2006. The movie came out in May of 2006. So we hadn't seen the movie yet. So he sent us this book. This book is called The Arts of Making Cars, and this book is the one that he wrote on the inspirations up and down Route 66. And look what's in the very first page. In Galena, Kansas stands a lone inspiration for the character Mater. Not Baxter Springs, not Riverton, not Pittsburgh, but Galena, Kansas.
Melba explains that the movie's producers also gathered inspiration from other nearby places.
The inspiration for that ghostwriting, that chimney, and that brick building is this building right here, and that's one of the oldest buildings in Galena. You go around to the side right there, you'll see the inspiration for the ghostwriting, the chimney, and the brick building. Also, when you go to Carthage, Missouri, at one time, there's 18 drive-ins on Route 66. There's now only three functional drive-ins on Route 66. Carthage is one of them. This is what it looked like when I was a kid. That's what it looks like now. That's at the beginning of the movie, and that's at the end. And you're standing in this building in the movie.
Melba recalls that when she and her sister Renee started the business, they had to get help from their partners.
We didn't have the money to buy the truck back. The gentleman that has that biggest building down there, that the biggest business in Galena down there, is Mr. Larry Courtney. Mr. Larry Courtney asked if we wanted some partners. I said, oh yeah, well, we got his mama, Miss Betty Courtney, and his ex-wife, Miss Judy Courtney, and that is the four women on the route. Melba Rigg, Betty Courtney, Renee Charles, and Judy Courtney, which is now Judy Howell. Unfortunately, we lost Miss Bailey last year to a heart attack, so now we call Larry Lucille, because he's our silent partner. Now, this is another reason they call me. The mouth told me it does run. The keg on the back of Mrs. Gaston. Any place Totara goes, I go. And I'm the one that does the talking for him, so they call me the mouth. Now, there is a joke. We do call our car Totater, and I'll tell you why in a minute. The joke goes, do you know why Totater don't talk? Because Melba does enough for both of them.
Disney Pixar released the movie Cars 2 earlier this year, and in April, they returned to Galena to interview Melba.
They came here, and Michael says, now, when you go meet the mouth, don't think you're going to get out of there in 30 minutes. Well, they didn't believe him. They booked me from 10 to 12 because it was a Sunday. They didn't start the interview until 12:30 because we were packed with people, and this place was packed. They started my interview about 12:30. An hour and a half later, they were done, and they actually missed their plane flying home. And they called my sister and told my sister to tell Melba that she will be on the Blu-ray special features and DVD being sold in November, December on Cars 2. So actually, they took pictures of Galena, of the truck, of my brother's restaurant and everything. What there was, the reason they came here was they wanted to know how the movie Cars 1 influenced Route 66. So what I told them, every time we get people that come here, the first thing they ask you is this Radiator Springs? And what I tell them is no, because they think, you know, they see the mural over there. I said, no, the whole 2,448 miles of Route 66 is Radiator Springs, because you have a building, a piece of sign, some landscape, characters, all up and down Route 66 that are involved in the movie. So that is actually, Route 66 is actually Radiator Springs.
Although the old truck remains outside the shop, Disney asked the four women to rename it because of copyrights.
So what we did was we had a contest. Now, it was supposed to be a local contest, but it got on the internet. 198 entries came in, the farthest one being South Africa. This little girl, she lived in Galena. She named him Tater. We liked her coloring job, so we call our truck Totater, the inspiration for Tomater. That way we can sell postcards, T-shirts, and things like that to help us support Route 66.
The day the restored service station opened, Melba says they served food to about 315 people. She says the town, which was known for the mining of Galena, used to have a population of about 30,000, but now it's only 3,000.
This town died three times, once when the mines died, again when Route 66 died, and again when the drinking age went from 18 to 21.
Helping breathe new life into the quiet-looking Main Street area is the family-owned and operated business.
Now, my daughter used to work here, too. Now, in this picture, she's 16 years old, and she's like, oh, great, another one of Mom's crazy ideas, right? After about the third group of good-looking Italians, we had no problem getting her to come to work. Matter of fact, she beat us half the time. But she was a little upset when she found out that most Europeans know more about Route 66 than Americans. And it is true, because she did a survey and found out that the age group between 7 and 30 was the age group that knew absolutely nothing about Route 66. So she started an association called the Young Roadies of Route 66. She got smart enough to put it on Facebook. And she's trying to get about 250 members. I don't know what her count is right now, but she's doing really good. And we did that. She started that 2 years ago. So we started this business about 5 years ago, and I can truly say we were Route 66 dumb. We knew that 66 went to California because we traveled all the time.
Now, they are much more educated about the route, and Melba says they are trying to bring back Galena one building at a time.
Now, we have actually saved the bridge, which is right behind us. That bridge was built in 1923. And the road came through in 1926. It took us 3 years to save that. The town of Galena and us and everybody that want to save Route 66 pitched in to save that, and we did save that. It took us 3 years. We actually got a grant to restore four blocks up on Main Street. We got that going right now. We are actually restoring the building across the street, which is a 1930 brothel. We're going to bring that back to a bed and breakfast and Victorian tea room. It's going to take us a lot of money because you can't see it from here, but there's a big hole in the roof, and that's going to cost about $7,700 to repair. We also have the building across the street, which is actually a Dairy Queen and a diner, or Dairy Queen, but we couldn't bring it back to the Dairy Queen, so we use that for storage. And on down the street, the company also owns a building called Butts, which is a two-story brick building. We're going to make that into a Stonefire Pizza and Family Pub. So we got some really big plans, and we're negotiating the building across the street, which used to be one of the big, is one of the oldest buildings in town, and it actually used to be a gas company, too.
The reason Melba is passionate about this restoration project is because she feels it's a part of history worth saving.
It is a lot of work, but Route 66 is history, and it's not just for us. And yeah, I'm not going to say I'm not doing this for money, because I'd be lying, but it's actually for our future. My kids are into it. My nieces and nephews are into it. I have a niece all the way in Kentucky, and she just loves Route 66, and she pushes it from there. I have people in Wyoming, South Dakota, North Dakota, California, Panama City, Florida. They all know about Route 66. And it helps bring back history. Because a lot of your foreigners come in, the first thing they say, why do Americans not take care of their old buildings? If you've ever gone to Europe, you'll see all the beautiful old buildings that have been there for centuries. And the Europeans can't understand. These Europeans come through here, they save up to come. This is a big thing for them to do. Why do I want to save it? It's history, and everything should be saved as history, because you learn from history. You know, you learn from your mistakes, but you also learn from history. And
for Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
It's almost the middle of August, and it's Thursday, so Jody Beznoska, who is the Vice President of Communications from Walton Arts Center, is with me. Welcome.
Welcome to you. Welcome back.
Thanks.
Thank you. We have a couple of shows coming up left in the month of August, and then unbelievably, we're into September. But we have the Midtown Men coming up next week on Friday and Saturday. And as we've talked about, these are four stars from the original cast of Jersey Boys, singing music from Jersey Boys itself, but also other 60s music, and putting on an incredible concert that is just really high energy. They have a great band with them. And they will be here on Friday the 19th and Saturday the 20th for three performances total. There are still tickets available for all three shows.
That's a Friday night, Saturday matinee, Saturday night?
That's correct. Yep. 8 o'clock on Friday night, 2 o'clock and 8 o'clock on Saturday. And then a week later, we will finish up the KOAF Summer Jazz Series with Warren Wolf on Friday the 26th. That will be in Star Theater. And the following day, a very exciting day, we'll have the Fayetteville Roots Festival going on all over Fayetteville, really, but we will have performances at the Walton Arts Center, and you can get tickets on our website for the Roots Festival. And then it's September, and I can't really believe that it's September almost, but Theater Squared will begin their first show of the season, Boing Boing, the I'm using air quotes, the rollicking farce that was on Broadway just recently, and they're in rehearsals right now. It sounds like it's quite fun, quite funny, very fast-paced, madcap, you know, lots of laughs for that one.
You and I saw just a snippet of it couple of weeks ago.
That's right.
At an event, and it takes place when airline pilots were, you know, if you didn't want to be an astronaut, you wanted to be an airline pilot.
Exactly. In some ways, I think the spirit of it is a lot like Catch Me If You Can.
Yes.
You remember that,
mm-hmm.
that movie?
Very much so, yes.
Yeah, but the main character, you know, balances three different women in his life because they're all stewardesses. And, I mean, that's really all you need to know. And then, of course, mayhem
yes.
ensues.
But that never works.
Never works, but it sure makes for good theater.
Yes.
So that opens on the 1st of September, and they will be running for 4 weeks, I believe, actually. Mm-hmm. And the following night, on the 2nd, we will have the Charlie Daniels Band at the Amp. So we are winding down the Amp season right now. There's only a few more shows left in the fall. So the Charlie Daniels Band will be there in September, and then there's a couple of more leading on into the fall. And believe it or not, then Labor Day's here, and we're back from summer break, and everybody's in school, and it's hard to believe summer's winding down.
Public schools start Monday.
Yeah, can you believe that? I can't. And in the spirit of back to school, I thought it would be fun to spend a little bit of time talking about some of the kids' programs that we have coming up for the season. Now, they don't actually start until much later in the fall. They begin in October and November, but there's a whole host of them. And the great thing about our kids' programs is that they're pretty affordable. They're meant for parents and guardians and grandparents and aunts and uncles and babysitters to come with the kids. And there's a wide range of what you can enjoy. A lot of the kids' programming is based on literature and books that kids have read or will read. So we try really hard to actually connect them to the curriculum that they may be experiencing in the school. But then we also have, you know, great shows like in October we have Step Africa, which is obviously a step performance, mm-hmm. but extremely high energy, going to be very, very engaging for kids and for their parents as well. And of course, the Nutcracker coming in November. Mm-hmm. In December. But I really just wanted to get that on parents' radar, because a lot of kids in the region will experience these shows with their schools. Sometimes we bring in a show and we do two or three performances for schools, and then we do one for the public as well. But even if the kids see it in school, there's something special about seeing it with their parents.
Right, you can talk to your parents about
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Parents can talk to you if you're the kid.
And you can learn them. You can, you know, take the lessons from the play and, you know, take them back to your life. So I just wanted to get that out on people's radar, that there's a whole host of kids and family programming coming up this fall, and school schedules get really busy and sports schedules get really busy, so it's a great time now to go online and get those tickets. They're affordable, and you can just put them on the calendar and start getting your kids excited about coming out.
Do you get the least bit nostalgic or wistful or melancholy at the end of summer? I know it's been the hottest summer that we can remember, and so a lot of people are looking forward to autumn. I still kind of want to hang on to those summer days as much as possible.
Me too. I don't feel exactly like we got to enjoy as much of the summer as we usually do. You know, we didn't get as many picnics or as much floating on the river or, you know, just being outside in barbecuing, you know, because it was just so hot. Actually, with this rain and with the, there's some orange trees already. Mm-hmm. And I had a moment yesterday where I felt, oh my gosh, autumn is coming. Oh no, I'm not ready. I want summer to stay for a little while more.
Glad I'm not the only one.
Yeah.
But all those autumn things you talked about and the things that still have yet to go in summer, Walton Arts Center.
.org or 443-5600, or come down to the box office and see us. Our gallery is open, and it's open during the day, and because we don't have shows at night, you know, it's just free and open to everybody. So come on down and check us out.
All right, Jody, thanks.
Thank you.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Ithi Agnihotri-Motolkar.
We are inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio. And to my right is Bojadera Kuzmanova, all the way from
Austria, from
Vienna.
Yes.
And Dave Thomas, our longtime friend, all the way from
Fayetteville, Arkansas.
The reason that you are here is there is a concert Friday night featuring you, Bojadera, and Virginia Luque.
Yes.
And obviously I want to talk to you in a moment, but Dave, this concert is free?
It is free. It's called a classical outreach concert, and it's being hosted by Covenant Presbyterian Church, which is out Weddington. And it's something that Paul Sagan and I, Paul Sagan being the pastor there, have discussed for a number of years, his desire to do this. We've had artists that I work with that have come through and performed at the church. Christopher Barkening, Jubilant Sykes, and Virginia Luque has before as well. But this is the first time that there has been a specific classical concert, standalone concert, and so it's very exciting, and the opportunity to bring in two great artists, and many people are familiar with Virginia, of course, who's been with the orchestra twice here and at the Walton Arts Center and with the Walton Arts Center a number of times, and also with KUAF for two concerts, I think. And but Bojadera and Virginia have just worked together, and the first concert in Nebraska in April, and it was so good that the opportunity came up and we had to seize it.
Bojadera, how do you begin the conversation with another artist like Virginia Luque that you will be performing with? Do you have actual conversations of how you might work together?
That's an interesting question. Well, people are so different, and the different artists are like, each one is a different world. So I was very lucky when I met Virginia, because we just clicked from the very beginning. We didn't have to talk a lot. We just played, and it worked. We didn't have to talk too much about the music or say, oh, I want to hear this, please, would you do that and that for me? No. It was just play, and our ears are like that open, so that you anticipate what the other person is going to do, and you just play along, play with her. And the same thing she did with me, and it worked for us, it was such a great joy to play with each other. It was really fun.
Is that anticipation visual in any way? Do you need to look at it? No.
No, not really. I mean, I'm sure we can play with the back to each other, and it will be the same. It's just the music is something logical. Yes, it's emotional and everything, but it is logical as well. So you can't start a phrase that will bring you completely different, like, ending. No, it's you can anticipate what's going to happen in this phrase. And with some musicians, it's just a lot easier than with others. And with Virginia, it was very, very easy and very nice.
Now, while you're performing, are you mindful of your audience? Or do you have to completely block them out because this is sort of a meditative time for you?
No, I don't block them out. I play for them. It's sort of like I would take my audience on the same trip that I'm going. And it's always a different trip. Doesn't matter how often I'll play the same piece. It's always a different situation. It always sounds different. Like Bach Chaconne, for example, I've played it I don't know how many times in my life already, and it sounds different each time. So it's, of course, I have an idea about the whole piece, and it's more or less how I want to play it. But it is an art that you do in the moment, and it does, how do you say, it does work out now and not like, yeah, it's not a recording.
It's known by your fans, your followers, that you have played many different violins.
Yeah.
Couple with some pretty famous names attached to them.
Yes.
But for the last 3 years, you've been playing a violin that was...
One year. For the last 1 year. Mm-hmm.
A new violin.
No, my own one is
your
a new
own,
instrument.
Well, I meant
yes.
New...
Yes, I own play a violin from Mathieu de Wust. He's a Belgian violin maker living in Vienna, and it's completely new instrument which was made for me. Since the last year, I play also an old instrument from 1740, which is from Carlo Testore. It's an Italian violin. So I have them both, and this time I have my own one with me.
What do you do to become familiar with a partner in music?
Yes, that's a good question. Well, I started playing different violins about 6 years ago. It was 2005, I think, 4 or 5. And I found out that I can swap instruments easily. Like go from one to the next in an hour and still play them very well, which is actually not that easy because they have all different, not only the sound is different, the measurements are different. And the violin is such a small instrument that even 2 millimeters are already a huge deal. And there is one instrument that I really had troubles with. That was the Stradivarius violin that I recorded on my last CD because she was one of the longer ones. So the body of the violin is more narrow and the whole thing is longer. So here you are playing for the last 30 years with one measurement of an instrument, and then you will make a jump from here to there in the violin, and you will end up completely different place. It's like, whoa, I have no idea what I'm doing here. So that was the one instrument that I needed to practice on. But other than that, I can actually swap easily. And I don't know if it's because I just love instruments and I love the violins and I really want to get out the best possible, the best they can give me, but I never push them. It's like I think of them like if that's a collection of queens. They're all very well educated, very well mannered, they're supremely intelligent and all that, but they're so different. And you cannot go to a queen and say, oh, hi, well, would you please do this and this for me? No way. You have to approach them with a lot of respect, and they do give you everything they want, but you have to make them wanted. Stradivarius violins are very touchy. if you try to push them, they don't want to be pushed at all. And if you let them sound, if you use more bow, no pressure, and just do what they want, then they're beautiful. They're gorgeous. And Guarnieri violins are exactly the opposite. They have huge tone, really huge. It's so rich and so beautiful. And some of them are like tractors. the work is like really heavy physical work, like on a field. But the result is fantastic anyway. So
it's something that Kyle and I were discussing before you guys came in,
yeah,
that we visited your website and you referred to these violins as women,
yeah,
you know, with personalities. And
well, they do behave like that. That's why I do it. They can be so gracious and so nice and so lovable, like so warm. Their sound can be so that just touch your heart with three notes. And they can be so extremely... What's the word for that?
Difficult.
Well, okay, difficult. Yeah, like prima donnas, actually.
Yeah. And violins are feminine to you, because you refer to them as she and queens.
Yes. Yes. When you look at their form and when you look at their character, then they can be actually only females.
Sure.
I suppose it's also it's because of the height of their pitch. That's...
I'm going to ask you to play that wonderful instrument here in a minute, but I do want to remind people the concert starts at 7.
7 o'clock.
And you don't have to even reserve?
You do not, but I think it'd be safe to say, just to be assured of a seat, particularly a good seat, get there early. And there'll be some refreshments as well at intermission. And but it's 7 o'clock. It's at Covenant Presbyterian, which is out Weddington, and it's just past the Catfish Hole on the left. And if people do have questions, there is a number I can give you, which
sure
is 442. What is it?
5267?
It could be 5267. That sounds real familiar.
Okay. 442-5267. And we should mention that you have at least four CDs, because there's... The Four Seasons. There's the most recent, which is...
the one with the four violins. No, it's not available yet for sale. It's still special edition, so I hope it will become available like in a couple of months.
Okay.
It's a demonstration, actually, that new CD, which is very exciting. There are four great instruments, and you take a work and play a movement, maybe on a Stradivarius, then a Guarnieri, and
yeah,
so on. And so people get to really hear the subtle differences, and sometimes not so subtle differences, between the violins. It's really interesting.
Of course, they sound a little different when they're recorded.
May we hear something?
Yes, sure.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
That is fantastic.
Thank you.
Bojadera Kuzmanova recorded in the Furman Garner Performance Studio yesterday. We'll hear more from the conversation and another performance on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large. Bojadera will be in concert tomorrow night with guitarist Virginia Luque. The concert is beginning at 7 at Covenant Church. That's at 4511 Weddington Drive in Fayetteville, just past the Catfish Hole on Weddington. And the concert is free.
And it's time now for our giveaway question.
And we will give away some more tickets to the Big Smith Late Show at George's Majestic Lounge on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. It's tomorrow night. It begins at 9 o'clock. We are going to give away three sets of Big Smith tickets, one of the best bands around. And the question revolves around drive-in movies, because tomorrow on the final stop of our Route 66 tour, Antoinette Grajeda will take us to a working drive-in in Carthage, Missouri.
Absolutely.
There are about 370 drive-ins left that are working, including one in Fayetteville, the 112 drive-in. The first drive-in was in 1937. The first drive-in movie was Wife Beware. Yeah, well, it was 1937 after all. Which state can boast that it had the first ever drive-in movie? Was it New Jersey, California, or Pennsylvania?
You can call up with your answers, 1-800-522-5823 or 1-800-522-KUAF.
New Jersey, California, or Pennsylvania, good luck.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 11th of August, 2011. It's the birthday of the fiction writer André Debus II, born in Lake Charles, Louisiana, 1936. Came from a Cajun-Irish Catholic family. Went to college, studied English, journalism, joined the military, served for 6 years, became a captain, married, had 4 children, and then pursued his real passion, which was writing fiction. He went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop. He was very happy there in Iowa City with his family. Published his first novel, The Lieutenant. Got a job teaching in New England. He was a popular professor, and his books of fiction were well received. But as his career took off, his family fell apart. And that's the story that his son, the novelist André Debus III, told in a recent memoir, Townie, came out this year, how his father, André II, left his wife and 4 children for a beautiful young student, never looked back. Meanwhile, his ex-wife and the 4 children were living a life of poverty in mill towns of Massachusetts. The elder André would show up once a week to take his kids out to eat, but seemed oblivious to how hard their lives were compared to his own. And then late on a summer night in 1986, the father, André II, stopped to help a couple of young people who had gotten into an accident on the road. He had just gotten out of his car when another vehicle swerved off the road and hit him. One of his legs was amputated. The other never recovered, so he was confined to a wheelchair. His wife left him within a year. He lived alone in a house out in the country on a steep hill. And his sons, including André III, came to rescue him. André III had a best-selling novel, House of Sand and Fog, in 1999, and soon after that his father died of a heart attack. André Debus II, who wrote, "The writer who endures and keeps working will finally know that writing the book was something hard and glorious, for at the desk a writer must try to be free of prejudice, meanness of spirit, pettiness and hatred, strive to be a better human being than the writer normally is, and to do this through concentration on a single word and then another and another. This is splendid work, as worthy and demanding as any, and the will and resilience to do it are good for the writer's soul. If the work is not published or is published for little money and less public attention, it remains a spiritual, mental, and physical achievement. And if in public it is the widow's mite, it is also, like the widow, more blessed. Here's a poem by Louise Bogan, The Dragonfly. You are made of almost nothing, but of enough to be great eyes and diaphanous double veins, to be ceaseless movement, unending hunger, grappling love. Link between water and air, earth repels you, light touches you only to shift into iridescence upon your body and wings. Twice born predator, you split into the heat. Swift beyond calculation or capture, you dart into the shadow which consumes you. You rocket into the day. But at last, when the wind flattens the grasses, for you the design and purpose stop, and you fall with the other husks of summer. The Dragonfly by Louise Bogan from The Blue Estuaries, published by Ferris Strauss and Giroux, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine. You can read the current issue of Poetry or listen to the monthly editor's podcast at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Kathy Roach and Nick Vetter. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time now for the answer to our question. Three winners that will be picked out of all the correct answers go into the ceramic cow. We'll pick three of those names out. Each of you winners will receive two tickets each to the Big Smith Late Show at George's Majestic Lounge tomorrow night at 9 on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. Question was,
which state had the first drive-in theater?
1937. The options I offered, New Jersey, California, or Pennsylvania. What do you think?
I know the answer.
You know the answer?
Yes, I do.
What is the answer?
Because I was looking over your shoulder while you were...
What is the answer?
New Jersey.
That's correct. 1937, the first drive-in movie ever was Wife Beware. Tomorrow we'll visit the Carthage, Missouri drive-in as part of our Route 66 tour. And Rogers Little Theater is now offering membership subscription packages for their 26th season. The main stage productions include Chicago, A Bad Year for Tomatoes, Hairspray, God of Carnage, and more. 631-8988 or rogerslittletheater.org for show dates, tickets, or more information. Don't forget the KUAF website giveaway is offering tickets to both the Fayetteville Roots Festival and the Theater Square 2011-2012 season. The drawings will be held Wednesday, August 24th during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Registration and information available on the web at KUAF.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, Brashears, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas.
And Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Ithi Agnihotri Madholkar.
Antoinette Grajeda will be with me tomorrow for a new edition of Ozarks at Large, beginning tomorrow at noon.